12/New Year's Day 2013, covering the fiscal cliff in the Senate Press Gallery. Sung Min Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post.
Was the solo reporter in news department on my first Christmas in biz, and 5 minutes before my shift ends on New Year's Eve, Y2K, woman takes hostage at a bank, and I am sent to scene for 5.5 hour standoff, as my wife waits for pickup for New Year's Eve party. Not a good phone call. Michael Mahoney, political reporter for KMBC-TV.
My name is Sarah, and I, for a long time, was a temporary producer and reporter at WNYC Radio in New York City. And one particular Christmas was incredibly memorable for me because I was scheduled to work both the day shift, producing All Things Considered, on the 24th and on the 25th. But I was also on call as a reporter on the evening of the 24th. And at about 9 p.m., I got a call from my editor saying, okay, it's on. You have to go to Northern Manhattan, go to this hospital. There's a woman who is waiting for a double lung transplant. And it turns out that the lungs are going to be sent over there, so if you could get up there as soon as possible. And I was going to be scrubbing in for the whole 6 to 8 hour long surgery. And I was super excited because, I don't know, I'd never seen anything like that before. And getting to watch it happen and getting to record it was a really exciting idea for me. So I went up there. And the woman was there with her husband and her toddler, this little girl who was like running around the room. And it was Christmas Eve, so they were singing carols and whatever. And, you know, we hung out. We just sort of like got to know each other. I turned on my recorder. And then around midnight, I remember thinking like, what is going on? So I pulled over a nurse and asked her, is the surgery going to happen? And she said, well, with organ donations, when we have something that's like a double lung transplant, what we do is we also have backup people ready just in case only one of the lungs is viable. And so there's actually another family downstairs in a different room waiting as well. And right now we're just waiting to find out if both of the lungs are viable or if it's only one. And so I was super surprised to learn that. I had no idea that there would be another family in the same hospital waiting downstairs with the same hopes and the same expectations that, you know, these organs are making their way across the country and they're prepping for surgery just like we were. And so that was sort of like, oh, okay, so someone for sure is going to be disappointed, which was kind of hard to learn because it was Christmas Eve and we're there and we're all getting ready. And so we were like, okay, well, we'll still wait. So we just stuck in there. There was nothing really to do, just to wait. And then a couple hours went by and one of the hospital officials came in to start sort of reading us through all of the fine print, I guess is what you would say. And she was telling us, you know, there's a possibility that even if we do get both lungs, that it might not work out. And it is a really intensive surgery. And that was when it sort of sunk in that this wasn't just going to be like something where I get to go and watch a surgery and just record the experience and see what's happening. It's going to all turn out fine. There was also a real possibility that a real person was going to lose their life and a real family was going to lose their mom. And it was suddenly very like, oh, I don't know that I want to be here. And right after that, the woman's sister and the sister's husband showed up. And I realized at that point that they weren't just saying Merry Christmas. They were also sort of hugging tearfully and, you know, potentially saying goodbye to this family member in case things didn't go so well. And at that point, we were done singing Christmas carols. We were just sort of hanging out, tense and waiting, trying to figure out what was going on. The toddler was exhausted, but like she couldn't go to sleep because there were so many people in the room and so many doctors and nurses coming and going and prepping. And me, like not knowing anyone on Christmas Eve, just sitting in a corner with my recorder, feeling like I was an intruder. And then probably around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, the doctor came in to tell us that only one of the lungs had been viable. And so the family downstairs was currently in surgery and that woman was going to go home with a new lung. And they apologized and they said, I'm so sorry. You know, there was such a buildup. And at the end, it was just so depressing and sad for this family to think like, what if she doesn't get the lungs that she needs. And, you know, everybody just sort of sat down and started crying. And I left, I turned off my recorder, I said goodbye, and I got on the subway and went home before my next shift that day. And I was like, it was really, really tough. It was really tough to go home after such an exciting night that started on such a high note. And then I don't know. I mean, at least to think there was another family in there that did get their Christmas miracle and they were super excited. And, you know, the organs didn't go to waste, but for that room, it was really tough. So I've stayed friends with her on Facebook, and a little while later, this has been about 2 years ago, she did get her double lung transplant, and she is doing well. She, you know, has still her little cute little family with her toddler who's growing up, and I don't think is a toddler anymore. But yeah, so it is a happy story in the end, because she did get her double lung transplant. My name is Sarah Barrett. I used to be a temp reporter and producer at WNYC in the newsroom in New York City.
All right, that's your Canada Land. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Journalist and author Jan Wong. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
How dare you ask me that question. Today on the show, give me that sweet, sweet Google money. How Bill C-18, the Online News Act, is shaking out for us and for other news startups. Welcome back to Shortcuts, Jan, where we talk shit about the news.
Great.
The standoff with Google over the Online News Act has come to an end. Now, Google will continue to post links to Canadian news sites, and the company will share some of the ad revenue it earns. It's going to be making annual payments to news providers in Canada of $100 million.
So, Jan, you can be forgiven if you are not following every development in the story of Bill C-18, the Online News Act.
Yeah, I'm not following it. Too much is going on in Gaza. I can't follow C-18. What is C-18?
So I'm following it both because media policy interests me and, full disclosure, I'm following it because I'm hoping to get paid at the end of this thing. I am a news publisher. And while Canada Land takes the position that we will not accept media subsidies from government, this money from private companies that is being constructed as licenses for news that are being handed out to our competitors and have been for years, yeah, we want that. We're already at a disadvantage because our competitors are getting all this government money. We have no problem taking Google's money.
How much do you think you're going to get?
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about money. What was predicted by government was a lot more than what we're going to get. And let's hear the new Heritage Minister, Pascal St-Ange, answering questions about that.
$100 million doesn't look like very much. I mean, earlier this year, the Heritage Department said Google would have to pay at least $172 million a year to avoid regulation by the CRTC. So that seems like a bit of a letdown.
Well, there's been a lot of numbers that have been thrown out there.
Well, this was by your government.
Yeah, so it's a lot less. $172 million is a lot more than $100 million. What the government was imagining was that, you know, Canada never does anything first. It was only after some of the news companies, Rupert Murdoch specifically, succeeded in getting money from big tech in Australia that Canada was like, okay, we'll get the same or more. But in fact, Google and Facebook saw that and did not want to set a precedent, because now that's going to go on all around the world. California's going for this as well. So they're like, no, we got to shut this shit down. Facebook pulled news links entirely to let every other country know, don't even ask us for money or we will remove news links from Facebook entirely. And all the people screaming at each other about politics will be doing so without any verified information. They'll just be screaming at each other over nonsense. And they proved that by doing it in Canada. And Google said, we'll give a lot less in Canada. The $172 million was based on precedent set in Australia. So to your question of what are we going to get, I don't know exactly. There's all kinds of backroom stuff that we were not a part of in terms of divvying it up. But the broadcasters are getting 30% of the $100 million. CBC is getting 7%. And the remaining 63% is going to all the newspapers and digital news sites altogether. The estimates I'm aware of is that it's going to be paid out on the basis, I hope fairly, everybody gets the same based on how many journalists you employ. I was pushing with some other publishers for it not just to be based on full-time employees, but freelancers as well, because a lot of smaller digital companies don't have full-timers. We do. And so the estimates are you're going to get somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000 per full-time employee.
Wow.
So it ain't nothing. It's fine. But one thing that I have been talking about throughout this is the extent to which this has really been bad for new companies, digital companies. And if we're figuring out the winners and losers here, this is what I can tell you. Some of the big newspapers might be losers because they had private deals with Facebook that are done now. And their private deals with Google, my understanding is they may be downgraded. I don't know that for sure. Certainly they're losing the Facebook money. Now, the funny thing is that when everybody lost the Facebook traffic, that was worth something to us. So the result of the government getting involved here, Facebook says it was worth like $230 million a year. That's probably an overstatement. But let's say it's half of that, $115 million a year. So we lost $115 million a year in referrals from Facebook, and then we get $100 million from Google. Well, we're coming up behind. That's particularly important for small publishers. And who do we really care about? People who are launching news companies in local community, right? That's where, like, we do not have news in many communities. And that's where Facebook is vitally important for letting people know, because everyone's got some community page in these communities where there's no newspaper. That's where you want to buy what are called lead ads, where you build up a newsletter by getting everyone's email address. That's where you advertise and let people know there's now a community newspaper, and you can't put your content on Facebook anymore. And you can't get any referral traffic that you don't pay for from Facebook anymore. So the loss of Facebook is particularly bad for small publishers.
Facebook is gone permanently? That wasn't just a tactic?
I think Facebook is gone permanently. That's what they've said. And everybody in government thought they were bluffing. But I was aware that Zuckerberg, even before this Canada stuff, had said, because he was taking all kinds of shit for Facebook's role in polluting American democracy, blah, blah, blah. And he said, you know what? Our users don't even like news. It makes Facebook a negative experience. So the algorithm was already punishing news all around the world. And we were seeing that we were getting way less organic traffic. And then Canada's like, give us money and calling them thieves. And I think that they said, you know what? Let's see what happens when we turn news off in one country. And they're telling us, and there's actually some independent research to back this up, that people like Facebook more without news. They like it more. And they haven't lost any traffic.
So depressing.
And I'll tell you this, Jen. I'll tell you this. Winners and losers. So I don't want to shit on a company called SixBuzz because I like weird types of information and they do like people getting in a fist fight in a local Burger King, okay? They are not doing journalism and they don't call themselves journalists. They don't list themselves as media in that way and as reporters. And because they don't list themselves as news, they did not get banned from Facebook and Instagram. So they're not going to get this money, but they've had Instagram all to themselves. All the other local media got kicked off of Instagram. And SixBuzz, which often has people ranting about politics or things that are news adjacent, they've got the whole news of younger audiences to themselves. So non-journalistic information wins. But here's the main new thing that I know, and I don't think has been reported. Nobody new is getting this money who doesn't get in now. It doesn't open up again for 5 years. So at a time when we desperately need new news organizations, they are sitting around a table, and I'm going to try to take my place at that table to get our piece of the pie of this $100 million. And then it gets locked in, and nobody new can get into this, I am told, for 5 years.
Okay, so who's at the five-year rule?
This is basically Google has bargained for this with government, and it completely contradicts. The original law was like, hey, it's a law. It's for everybody. Any news company that is being shared on Google should be getting money from Google.
5 years is a lifetime for a media startup.
Well, at this crucial moment, like this is a big disincentive for even starting because you're getting into a industry where there are incumbents who are getting all kinds of government. And the other government subsidy, the wage subsidy, that one you need to be in business for like at least a year before you can get any of it. So you're looking at that crucial first year of your news organization and like it's looking like they just doubled the government subsidy. Because the newspapers were so pissed off that Facebook left that the government had to make them whole. So here we're getting punished again for not taking government money. Our competitors are now getting twice as much government money. So we can probably survive that. But if you're thinking of starting a news company in Canada, you're like, every dollar I spend, my competitor only has to spend 50 cents.
So that 100 million is also a fixed sum. It's not ever going to grow in these 5 years where they've locked out.
It's a fixed sum. And the deal is that, that doesn't matter how many news organizations, doesn't matter how many news jobs we lose in Canada or gain, it's $100 million a year for 5 years.
That's not good, that the pie will never grow.
And this is these are the terms that Google was offering a year ago before Facebook left. This has been bungled so revoltingly, mostly to the detriment of the newsreader.
So it's been negotiated by the government with Google, obviously.
That's right. What's happening is Google was like, we're going to leave too. We're gonna stop indexing news in Canada too. And after Facebook, you know, the government who, under the previous Heritage Minister, they were so sure that big tech was bluffing, and then they completely folded their hand after Facebook left. They're like, oh shit, big tech actually might leave.
So are you, how much are you gonna get? You didn't answer my question.
I don't know. So
how many employees do you have?
Well, it only covers full-time journalists, and I think that we're like somewhere like in the 10 to 11 full-time journalist range.
So it's $250,000.
Well, if it's $10,000 per journalist and we get it, which isn't guaranteed yet.
I thought you said it was $20,000 per full-time journalist.
It's somewhere, we don't know. It'll depend on the split and how many people are at the table. So it's somewhere between 10 and 20.
Okay.
Is what's estimated. Somewhere between 10 and 20.
And is it taxable?
Ooh, I don't know.
Everything's taxable.
Yeah, why not? It's revenue from licensing.
Tricky of Ottawa to do this.
And we might not get it for, like, people are saying that checks might not be like 6 to 12 months, you know.
In other words, it's not much money.
You know what? We operate at such slim margins here. We have, you know, that like if we get $100,000 more a year or $200,000 more a year, it actually makes a significant difference. And
okay,
after the headaches and having to get involved in like lobbying, which as a journalist I did not want to do, but as a publisher I had to do, after all of this and talking about policy, which bores people to tears, yeah, I'm cashing that check and it's going to go back into the journalism, but I might buy myself a bottle of liquor as well.
Well, you could also hire that warlord lobbyist in Montreal to do your lobbying for you.
What should we lobby for?
Well, lobby for a 1 year moratorium on newcomers. Send him in. I bet he can do a good job.
I have to wait until I'm guilty of the international crimes I'm being accused of before I need his services. Jen Wong, it always makes me feel a little bit better to have a conversation with you. Thank you.
It's always so much fun. Thanks, Jesse.
Jen, we duly note stories. I have a couple to duly note. And lots of stuff is happening as society unravels, and we have to care about everybody who it's happening to. That is what brings me to the story I want to duly note, which is Rupa Subramania, who had been, I think, a conservative columnist for the National Post and is now working for a site out of the States called the Free Press. She has become the target of trolls and harassment, vicious racist stuff, anti-Hindu stuff from the right wing, I think from people in the audience that she normally plays to. It is not okay. There are a couple of things. There was a video of a bunch of Indian kids singing in Punjabi at a hockey game, O Canada. What a heartwarming Canadian scene. What? It's hockey, it's O Canada, but look, we're inclusive. And people commented and said, what the hell is happening to Canada? What language are they speaking? That's our song. And then another thing that happened was like a Hindu temple built a statue of a Hindu deity. And this became seized upon, like, you can't put up a John A. McDonald statue, but you can put this monstrosity up. Look at what they're doing. They're claiming Brampton as a Hindu. Like Hindus now? We're mad at Hindus for like. So there are people, I think, kind of in the audience that she normally plays to who are getting really ugly and bigoted. And she spoke up and said, whoa, this is way off. That argument is completely fallacious. The John A. McDonald thing, which, and she's not in favor of taking the statues down, has nothing to do with this.
I'm in favor.
Me too. You can put up a Buddha, you can put up a Jesus, you can put up a Hindu deity, you can do it. And she just got the worst kind of shit. And I don't know that she was supported by anybody who she is associated with in the right-wing media here. But I think it's important to lend support to people who are fighting racism, whatever political quarter they come from. And I wanted to duly note that bullshit.
Duly noted.
What do you have?
I don't have an actual story. I have something that happened to me. First of all, let me ask you this. Do you shop?
I do.
Do you shop for groceries?
I do.
And when you're at the cash, do you watch them? Do you watch it like a hawk?
My dad taught me well, former grocers and chicken peddlers, who you do not take your eye off the cash.
Good. So have you ever noticed that something was scanned incorrectly?
Oh, yes. And I love those moments.
And so you know then You know your rights.
I know that then they have to give it to you for free, don't they?
Pretty good. The actual policy is that if it's under $10, you get it for free, but just one. So if you bought six things of Häagen-Dazs and you were scanned incorrectly, you only get one free.
Oh, you know it well.
Unless there are different flavors, in which I would have a huge fight there. And if it's over 10, they have to take $10 off the lowest marked price.
Ah.
Yeah, so I was at this upscale Korean grocery store and I bought half a chicken. You know, they're delicious fried chickens. And I went through this whole thing with them. It was a special, but they charged me the regular price, blah, blah, blah. And the interesting thing was I really had to fight. And in the end, the woman at customer service, she was still trying to, like, fool me. It's $10 off the lowest marked price. I just thought, everyone's writing about grocery prices. They're cheating you at the scanning machine. And why is this policy in place? It's the Retail Council of Canada adheres to it, and all the big stores have signed on Loblaws, you know, Canadian Tire, Costco. Why? It's there because they're supposed to punish you. If you have a flyer ad or you have a special and the customer buys it, but at the cash, you charge them the full price. I would say 95% of people don't notice. Only you and I notice. So I just want all Canada Land listeners who are so kind to support Canada Land to make sure you get your $10 discount as soon as they do it.
We got to put that out there.
I should have walked through the whole grocery store and told every customer, hey, quickly, go get that fried chicken because you're going to get it for $3. Oh, and it's good for things at Zara too.
Oh, okay. Duly noted. I got one here I want to share with you. This is so wild. I interviewed one of the most fascinating people I've ever interviewed on the show is this guy, Ari Ben-Menashe. He had an office above a Burger King in Montreal from which he lobbies for warlords. He takes contracts for dictators and despots. That's his job. He's basically the lobbyist of last resort, is how he's being described. And he makes millions of dollars when they want to have influence or talk to governments and they don't have direct access. They hire this guy. I was amazed that he did the interview with me, and it's really worth listening to. But he was back in the news this week. Adrian Humphries wrote about him in the National Post because he feels that he is being persecuted by the prime minister. And I'm like, come on, man. But then you read the thing and you find out he hasn't been able to open a bank account in Canada for the past 10 years because bank after bank refused him as a client. He also lost his elite American Express Centurion card, a black titanium credit card with no limit. He's suing the banks and the credit card company. And recently, he's been audited. He's fighting the CRA, a tax dispute where they've been auditing him for, you know, returns back to 2012 and his company and his wife. And what got him in the news is that he just lost his driver's license because he can't get insured. All the insurance companies cite moral risk. So I actually left this article thinking, like, maybe they are out to get him. Maybe somebody is, like, they can't find a legitimate...
I think they should get him.
Maybe they should, but I don't really feel outraged on his behalf. But I do feel like when the government decides to f*** with an individual and they can't go after them in a direct way, what can the government do? And do they do this stuff?
Is it actually a whole campaign? Or is this just because, you know, insurance companies, they're happy to, if you're a risk, they're happy to not insure you.
But who has gone to the insurance company and said this guy's like, he's unable to prove that there is a prime ministerial campaign to ruin him. But there are a lot of data points that
I
wanted.
Doesn't he do an FOI request?
Ooh, I'm going to call him up because we're on those kinds of terms and have a chat with Ari Ben-Menashe, and I'll suggest that.
It's very hard for me to feel sorry for him. I'm sorry. You know, I just can't find it in my heart. Duly noted.
All right, that's Shortcuts. You can email me about it at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. Jan. Where can people find you?
I'm still on Twitter, to my shame. I'm at Writer Wong.
Get it? Right or wrong, Writer Wong on Twitter. This episode's produced by Jess Schmidt with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Happy holidays. Happy New Year.